I think we have some time for questions, if you'd like.
We have some time for questions now.
Sushil Vanna from Planet Finance in New York, where I was neighbors.
Yes.
I just had a question for you. What is the maximum loan you're willing to extend in New York, and do you see a need for more capital in credit in the coming years?
The program that we have starts with the loan of $1,500. The potential to increase that loan, there's an incentive program within the loan where they can increase the size by about 20% per year. So, and there's different parts of that incentive program. If they pay back their loan properly and timely during that first year, they can increase their loan by 10%. If the group that they're in, the group of five, also pays their loan properly, they can get another 5%. And if the center that they're part of does the same high performance, that gives them the ability to go up 20%. So we do grow, 1,500, 1,800, 20, 2,200. We do have a few loans within our portfolio of $3,000. Those are from the beginning when we started at that level. We did not deliberately reduce any of those borrowers. We do not see Grameen getting to the point of $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 loans in New York. And there's some other organizations that provide, like Axion provides loans that maybe they start at that level. We would like to graduate our borrowers to other micro credit companies. We're not in it. It'll be efficient for us to be raising the size of the loans, but we'd rather stay at the level where we're at, and that's our program. Was there a second part of your question? I'm sorry. The access to capital?
Right. We're working on an equity product for small entrepreneurs in New York. And because we feel that equity is also a big part of financing businesses. And you're talking about graduating borrowers to a higher level. So for instance, working with Citco, who goes up to $200,000 in debt, would be interesting for us to partner with them or with you on an equity product as well, just to make sure that we cover every aspect of the financial, of access to financial services in New York.
Okay, that's great. Well, we met with the New York State, and we were on one of their task force, and they were talking about microcredit. And the first meeting that I attended, I asked the question, how do you view microcredit? And they said, well, anything that's below $250,000. So I stood up and I said, I guess I'm not needed here. So it was an education process. They will try to do programs for us.
Good question here.
Okay. I have a question about demographics of your members or participants. It sounds like it's the vast majority are females. And could you sort of give a little more detail in terms of age range, single parents, and so on?
Okay. We are 100% women.
100%.
Grameen Bank in Bangladesh is 97% women. And it's not that we exclude men. We have some onerous... I shouldn't say. The men think we have onerous terms to our loan product. You have to come to a weekly meeting. You have to pay the loan back on a weekly basis. We have had men who have gone through the 5 days of continuous training because it's only, an hour a day for 5 days. They can do that. They can put $2 a day into a savings so that at the end of the week they have $10. That was no problem. But when they heard they had to come every week to pay back the loan, they said, not for me. I'll pay it once a month. I'll show up. I can give you the money. And we said, well, that's not the program. So what's happened is the men have dropped out of the program, but the family still needed the money. So the wife would come in and join the program. And so she took the money. She went to the meetings, and she bought him the food cart that he's working. So we've seen that happening on a regular basis. The same thing took place in Bangladesh. When they first started the bank, women would not borrow. Only there was... many reasons, cultural, religious, social, And at the beginning, it was a struggle to get to 50-50, men, women. They have not made a new loan to a man since 1985 in Bangladesh. So eventually they will be 100% women. But all the studies that we have seen show that if a woman has access to capital, it winds up going to provide three things: health coverage, education, and clothing for the children. And so, therefore, we don't think there's anything wrong with that part of the program. Most of our borrowers are from the immigrant community. I don't know the exact number, but it's over 70% Latino population. The market and our borrowers reflect what our center managers look like and who they are, because it's a local. These are local people. So when we hire someone from Bangladesh to work for us as a center manager, they go to their community and they are bringing in people who are Bangladeshi. And when we have someone from Mexico, they bring in Mexican. And this is very common. The same thing happened in Omaha. We have the same type of ethnic background of our borrowers. As far as the age, it ranges from young people in their 20s to, you know, seniors. We're not concerned. As long as they have ambition, as long as they have a business plan, and business plan is a verbal, it's not a hard document. I want to buy a food cart, and that's a business plan as far as we're concerned.
Your, I guess, the focus of your program from $3,000 to $1,500. And I'm not from business or finance. I'm from health. And I would have probably said, well, we'll just loan less money, you know, but not change the actual aims of the program. So I'm wondering if you could share with us why and how, why that was important and how you did it and the, sort of the fundamentals of making that decision.
Okay. Important elements of the program are people participating in all aspects of the program. And as the size of the loan could get larger, the loan was $10,000, person takes the money, doesn't have that real need to want to go through the program. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of effort to meet once a week when you have other things to do. But it's beneficial to the program. And we found that we weren't able, we're not getting financial statements from our borrowers. We're not getting their tax returns. We're just going to their homes, and there's a form that they use in Bangladesh, and we're using the same thing. It's going to someone's home to confirm that they do not have assets, as opposed to a bank would go to someone's home to confirm that they have a car in the driveway, they have the house is well painted. We want to make sure they don't have a big screen TV. We can tell that they're poor because there's usually two families or maybe three families living in a home or an apartment as opposed to one. They don't have a lot of assets or they have a lot of children. We can, when they tell us they're living below the poverty line, we can believe them because we can see it. When we were getting borrowers who were at that higher level, it was harder for our managers to really know whether they were below the poverty line or whether they just wanted access to the money. And so that was the real bottom line of what it was. And the results were that the repayment rate has been almost 100% since we made that change. We've had a couple of borrowers at the beginning that were slow. We had two borrowers in our history that skipped. So that it's a remarkable program.
It was very interesting to hear the, as you explained, the lowering of the part of for taking the loans. I mean, what builds this trust on either side between the lending and the borrower? And are there other community activities which you do undertake or you tend to undertake in sort of strengthening this activity?
Okay. The building of the trust was an interesting thing at the beginning. The borrowers did not trust us. They didn't want to take them. We were giving them the money, and they were saying, we don't trust you, because they were concerned that we were going to... one of our managers was asked, is he from the mafia? You know, he's putting out the money and expecting it to be paid back. What happens if I can't pay you back? You know, so that was a trust factor. We go through this five-day training program, and we educate the borrowers. We show the borrowers how important it is to give them the money. We tell them that it's extremely important that we get the money back from you. This is not charity. This is a loan. You have an obligation to pay us back the money that we lend. And the reason you have to pay back the money is because there's another borrower who's going to need it. And if you don't pay us back, we can't relend that money. We recycle our money every year, basically every week. Money comes in, and we lend it back out to new borrowers every single week. So that program is a recycling of money, so there's a responsibility. When they form the group in this peer lending model, when I first saw it, I said, oh, so it's just a group of five people. You put them together. It's not a big deal. You know, the five of you can get together and come. That's not the way the model works. You have to find five people that you, or four other people that you know, that you trust, that you want to work with and be with on a weekly basis. So the groups are formed by those individuals. So there's a lot of self-selecting and a lot of process that goes into this approval to make the loan. And because they're coming to us and we're giving them an alternative to going to these high-priced money lenders and payday lenders and other places, and we're charging a relatively low interest rate, they appreciate what we've done for them. We've given them, you give someone $1,000 to buy a machine that they weren't able to buy for their business, and they do really appreciate that they got that money, because there's no one else who's going to give them the money. And so if someone helps you, there's a real obligation that they take to pay back because we help them. And I invite anyone who would like to see a loan disbursement, visit with our borrowers. We have open houses that we conduct a couple times a year in New York, and you can see and meet with the borrowers and hear the stories. And
I have two questions. One, you were in the mainstream investment before. What could you think of the way mainstream investment works that could improve what microfinance a la Grameen can do? What do you think, what lesson or what insights can Grameen have in terms of feeding the development of the mainstream finance? That's my question A. And B is how, what I would like to hear is, if we are having this discussion within the context of a program on reducing health inequity, how could you think of better weaving what you do to help reduce health inequity more directly in some way?
The second one's a very hard question. There's an element, and we will hear much more about this tomorrow from my close colleague Hans, talking about social business. There is a different thinking that has to go into the microcredit business that we're doing. Yes, there's a lot of things that I can bring from my past experience on being more efficient on how we spend money. I can be efficient on how we buy things. I can be efficient on how we operate and on controls and all the business elements that are related strictly to doing better, because we want to become a sustainable business and we want to do it efficiently. But I don't go into our center managers and our branch managers and say, how much money did we make on our interest income this month? I don't ask them that. I ask, how many loans did we put out? I don't ask them how much we've collected back from our borrowers as a percent to worry that we're at 1.1% or 0.9%. I only worry because I want 100%. I don't want anyone to not pay their loan. Because if we have someone who didn't pay the loan, we lent money to the wrong person. And it's not the poor person that doesn't pay us back. It's the one that was too rich. It's a terrible process that if you don't have any money, you pay back. And if you have a lot of money, yeah, I don't have to pay you back. And it's, you know, so maybe that's the answer to your question that you had before about 1,500. Maybe that gets people who really want to pay you back. And at 3,000, they can walk away. I don't think we're that scientific, but it does get to that direction. I'm sure a $100 loan, we'd never have a loss. How we can implement this to go into healthcare, and then we can finish on social business. A social business has to have good, strong people running that business. Otherwise, it will not work. You can't just say, I have a brilliant idea, and you know, obviously I'm going to make a social business and hope. It doesn't work like that. You have to have the top people. And you should answer, but I'm going to try to answer for you, and feel free to step in. You have to have the top people at these organizations who are committed to the program. Maybe they're not putting billions of dollars into it. Maybe they're only putting $1 million into the program. But you have the executives at the top of that organization that want that program to be successful. Veolia only wants to know how much can they put in a program that can get 100,000 people to get purified water from that project. And if that project will work, then they decide whether they want to open up a second project. And each one of those companies have their own mission, and this is what's done. And they are not being run by the low-level people who don't have any skill. They are being operated by the best people. And that's important when you want to set up a social business. In health and healthcare, and we had part of this discussion last night, I am coming, the United States has the worst healthcare system I've ever seen. We need to scrap it and start all over again. So what would I do? I would try to figure out a way to do a social business in healthcare and figure out what is needed to provide, and maybe it shouldn't be called healthcare, maybe it should be called health. And if we call it health, then maybe we will get a lot further, because if you can do all the things to keep people healthy, you don't need a healthcare system.
Okay. Thanks very much, Stephen Bogle. I